You're listening to Tunnel Vision, a 10-part series in which me, Bruno Involucri, leads a collection of writers, musicians, activists and academics through London's sewer system, inviting them to explore the space historically and acoustically. Each week, the series offers listeners a different take on the miles of forgotten Victorian tunnel that stretch beneath London's surface. This week, in the last of Tunnel Vision's excursions below ground, we're joined by Stephen Smith, Newsnight correspondent and author of Underground London and Underground England. Describing London as an iceberg, Stephen set out to explore the part the majority of us only see from inside the tube or the bottom of a North Yorkshire cave. It's a forgotten world which, in Stephen's books, acts as a personal as well as historical entrance into the national psyche. Having been through London sewers once before, courtesy of Thames Water, we invited Stephen on a slightly less legitimate trip through the system to see if his experiences could shed some light on our explorations. We joined Stephen, accompanied by Thomas Turnbull, beneath Brockwell Park. I began by trying to find out what motivated him to explore below ground. So where did your kind of motivation for Underground England, well, for London first, I suppose, and then England come from?
Well, it was very paradoxical, actually. I suppose it's a funny thing to be talking about in a dark, cold, isolated tunnel, but it came from fear. Not so much of the dark and the unknown, but a claustrophobia about using the tube, the underground, which is quite common. I know lots of people, reporters who've been to war zones and so on, who hate the tube, won't go on it. I had been living in Yorkshire, where the caves are, of course, and travelling around on a mountain bike and just enjoying the good life. And then I came back to London and I was using the Jubilee line in peak time every day and really hating it. And one of the things I did to distract myself was, like counting sheep, I suppose, was to look at the famous Harry Beck map of the underground. And I realised that although it kind of joined up all the stations, it was a kind of join the dots thing, there was a lot of space between that wasn't covered in the map. And I thought, well, what else is down here? And so, somewhat tentatively, I began this underground exploration. And I found that the time I spent in the tube, the odd times, the sort of times that the ordinary passenger doesn't see, walking through the tunnel at night, a bit like we're doing here, or going in the cab of a train, cured me of that claustrophobia, at least as far as the tube was concerned.
Right.
So that was the rather paradoxical starting point. You know, it's not very often, if at all, that you can say, I've discovered a new bit of London, but keep sliding here. But I went with some miners into a tunnel they were digging at Cricklewood.
Yeah.
And they weren't extracting coal or gold. They were extracting air. They were building this pristine tunnel that the electricity people could lay a new supply through. And they had this amazing machine, this tunneling machine, which ripped at the earth and at the same time put up these concrete rings to line the tunnel. And I got up to the head of this machine and patted the wall and broke a bit of London clay off. And okay, it's nothing could be more prosaic than a lump of mud, but at the same time, this was a bit of London that people hadn't been to before, right under our feet. Now, what has Tom found?
I've found one of those delightful toilet blocks that keeps your toilet lovely and fresh. And
it looks like it's been rigged up there, but I suppose it's just been snagged on this handrail.
Yeah, it's kind of convenient, isn't it?
Yeah.
You wouldn't have thought one of those would fit down
there. Maybe some life in that. I'd like to take
it
back. And
just tuck it in your bag. BBC wages aren't what they used to be.
They are. Not for all of us. And as I was saying, you know, my interest began out of fear. But we repose everything that we hold most dear, as well as things that disgust us underground. You know, the whole idea of buried treasure is about hiding what's valuable out of sight. But equally, all the nasty stuff, the dead bodies, and this stuff we're sloshing through all gets sent down here. So, yeah, I mean, the associations of the darkness, of hell, of things from our bodies that we are troubled by, They're all linked to the subterranean.
I suppose there's also a kind of fear of disorientation.
Absolutely, yeah.
In the world.
Absolutely.
I mean, in your book, it was quite interesting reading about the guy, I think his name was Spurrell.
Spurrell.
Found someone in this kind of pit who thought he'd been crawling around a maze of tunnels for a couple of days.
That's right, he was in the Dean Holes in Kent. You can just imagine, I mean, you and Tom know your way around down here better than I do in this bit. But if one of us was here without light, there was more water, you could easily get disorientated after a while, get cold, hungry, confused, morale would drop. And this guy Spurrell wrote about, he'd been wandering around these Dean Holes, imagining that he was in some vast catacomb, but actually just going round on himself and seeing the same, very similar bits of cave, as it were, over and over again.
Yeah. And he was actually rescued, was he, this guy?
I think he did get out to tell the tale, yeah.
Well, here we are at another manhole. The funny thing about these is they've got pebbles at the bottom, and I don't know where they come from.
I suppose that's people and cars just scuffing them over here, and
they eventually
accumulate and gather.
Yeah.
Or it could be a bit of builder's aggregate that they didn't want anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about the disorientating effects. Hand on heart, I wouldn't know how far we've walked now, and I suspect I would err on the long side. You know, probably haven't gone all that far at all. Okay, well, I'm no subterranean engineer, but we're at the sort of confluence of three routes. There's two sewers ahead of us. They're lower ceilinged round tunnels, and off to the right is a dripping staircase, and above us a manhole cover. So we're at a fork in the road, basically, aren't we here?
Yeah. Yeah, so what we can do, basically this one to the left, will lead us stooping to a river and our exit manhole.
Okay.
This one leads to a manhole which unfortunately is jammed up.
Right.
And this one, basically, it's quite short. Maybe if you shine your light, you can see the end.
Yes, I can see something at the end.
And it goes to a kind of chamber.
Oh, yeah.
With a gravity flap.
Right.
So what I thought we could just kind of stoop through there, have a look at it.
Yeah, and then come back
and
go up there. Let's try that then.
Right.
Well, we're in. Most sewers are kind of egg-shaped so that the crap doesn't collect at the bottom. This is more of a tube, and it's a much lower ceiling than the one we were last in. Something nasty has just brushed my eye there. So we're doubled over going up this sewer, which is. It feels more like a concrete drain pipe. The last bit we were in was nicely pointed brick.
This tunnel might be a good place to do a reading.
Oh, okay.
It'll take a crouch, but what's nice about it is the acoustics. They're so kind of sharp.
I wasn't ready for the press of the water through my waders. It was like the experience of the 5th Duke of Portland as he explored the tunnels under his Nottinghamshire estate in The Underground Man by the mole-eyed novelist Mick Jackson. The coldness of the tunnels first introduced itself at my ankles, then crept slowly up me, in the same way that a bather's body is coldly embraced by the sea. The water that I encountered was very far from being a tide, in truth. It was nothing compared to the pulse of a river. All the same, I was almost caught out by the kittenish undertow, nearly wrong-footed and humiliatingly upended into the far-from-appetizing drink. For a moment, I pitched and swayed on the spot, my feet seeking equilibrium. Bit more?
Yeah.
How to describe the waters which eddied and swirled playfully about me? In the half-light, it was easier to identify them by texture rather than by colour. The consistency was of a solution of mud with a denser sediment of grit underneath my flailing feet. As I found my balance and grew accustomed to the gloom, I could make out wisps of white in the water, like anemones or jellyfish, or alternatively like flakes of cuttlefish in a reeking gumbo, which I was obliged to catalogue as sheets of loot paper. I followed the flushes of my fellow visitors in single file through one bore of the northern outfield. It was known on their charts and plans as Barrel 5. We were making for a source of artificial light, which dimly illuminated the sweating brick of the egg-shaped tunnel. For a time, all you could hear was the sloshing of waders and the muffled roar of the far Niagaras of the sewer delta, and the faint sonar ping of Keith's gas monitoring device, like the alarm clock tick-tocking in the stomach of the croc in Peter Pan. I think this is a moment of psychogeography, reading it into the underground element. I don't think I've actually read any of it or carried it below ground before, so it's long overdue. Subterranean baptism.
All right, well, should we continue down this tunnel?
Let's do that. So we're back at that fork in the road. We're taking another fork. This looks as though it might be slightly bigger, this sewer, this tunnel. But again, it's not the lovely pointed brick that we first encountered. It's concrete. It's like any kind of industrial pipe, attractively splattered and festooned with growths, fungal growths, and growths associated with the damp down here. As I was saying before, what could be more man-made and artificial than this? And yet, London and nature is trying to reclaim it all the time. Just a little splash of water underfoot here, and the rumble of traffic overhead.
You can really hear that we're going below a main road here.
Can. More loom paper.
I mean, what's interesting for us, before the series was being made, was the exploration. I mean, we were coming down here originally in search of the Ephra. But I mean, have you done a lot of stuff around exploration? I know you've written about the kind of recurring myth of the fiddler.
Yes, exactly.
Used to explore tunnels.
Well, there's a whole wealth of folklore around tunnels. And you find this yourself. If you go anywhere in the country, and you maybe go to the local pub for a drink, get chatting to the locals, one of them will say, oh, this is supposed to be a tunnel from here to the graveyard. Or there's a tunnel from the castle to the abbey. And it's interesting that usually these are myths locating two places of importance in the community. And when we stop, I'll tell you about the blind fiddler. Yes.
Hello, what's this?
Just found some weird fungi growing in the sewer.
Oh, yeah.
It's the first time I think we've ever found anything living down here. They kind of look like cotton wool, and then some of them have...
They almost look like sea anemones or even small crabs, except they've got too many protuberances.
Yeah. It'd be terrifying if they skittered off, but... they're some sort of fungi, so we'll have to research.
There's a whole kind of natural world of fauna in caves, for instance, different types of mosquito and spiders that you only encounter down there. And these look a bit
species.
Like,
I have seen a frog down here once before.
Maybe you should lever that off, tweezer it off to David Attenborough.
Send it in an envelope.
Yeah,
I found it in the wild to Brockwell Park.
Yeah. Maybe it's just a bit of extruded, what's that stuff you use to clean your ears out with? Maybe it's
cotton bud gone wrong.
Yeah.
There's actually a David Attenborough show about the sewers. Well, it's about rats, but a lot of it's filmed in the sewers. He's saying how he absolutely hates them.
Yeah.
And hates the sewers.
They are ugly beasts. But I mean, the Toshers I met were fairly relaxed about rats. And they told me stories of this guy called Jack, who was this great rat killer, and he was a flusher. And when they encountered a sort of squirming rat king, Jack would stand or perhaps sit perfectly still and wait till he had one in his sights and keep waiting. And then he'd take his hard hat off and in a blur of moulded plastic he'd bring it down on this creature and kill it. He was a legendary rat killer of the sewers.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we always talk about kind of folklore or legends of the past being kind of the above ground loving people we are, but there's obviously current.
Well, they're being fresh minted all the time. I mean, one of the sewers, the Ranelagh sewer, you can get into in the grounds of Chelsea where the flower show is held, and it goes under Buckingham Palace. And Thames Water, people were saying to me, you know, it used to be their fear that the IRA would discover this place. Because it would be a perfect means of launching some sort of attack or royalty. It's definitely more of a sense of abyss now, isn't
it? Yeah, so the tunnel's really kind of filling.
Is this the Ephra we're approaching?
I'm not sure, because the Ephra's actually been split.
Right.
According to James Harold, who's the expert.
Yes.
Saying it's sewerisation, it was forked off, and it meets again. But I think it was more useful.
Okay.
As two rivers for pushing shit rather than one large one.
Well, we're climbing up some steps out of a nice bit of sweating brick, and that noise you can hear is the approaching sort of Nile Delta of poo that's rushing away beneath this part of South London. Very high given the recent rainwater. We're just picking our way over lovely little doilies of toilet paper to see it.
So here we are.
That's a good noise. Oh, look at that, there's a torrent there.
Yeah, we're going to need to shout quite loudly to get over
there. Yeah. It looks like a sort of conveyor belt of slurry rushing away in front of us.
Yeah, this is kind of the real thing, I suppose.
Yeah.
What you think of. This is actually the tunnel we tried to walk up. If you see this handrail here, this is the one that helped us on our way back.
Sure.
What I've never understood about this space is why obviously there's a ladder leading down from this manhole here in the far corner of the room.
Yeah.
Which drops into the running stream.
Yeah.
But then on the other side of the stream, there's a ladder leading to nothing other than a kind of bare ceiling.
Well, maybe it's just for getting up and down this gate here and maintaining it and inspecting it.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just a sort of safety point. You can climb up, get out of the current.
Yeah.
That's very fast, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
that's fast.
Yeah, it's flowing quite a bit. It looks kind of violent almost.
Yeah. So we've just had after a long dry spell, we've had a couple of days of rainy weather.
Yeah, so there'll be a kind of surge now, maybe.
Absolutely.
You can actually see the flat, because the river isn't at the deepest it could be, so just pointing up, there's this white kind of film.
You're talking about the high tide level?
Yeah, that's
sort of... It's very near that, I would say, if not there already. What a shame they can't harness the force of this for energy. Perhaps they do somewhere.
Yeah, that's very true,
On a day like this, you think that could run a few laptops or electric toothbrushes, at least.
What's interesting is there's this brickwork, and then it meets this concrete work, which is what we've been seeing as we've walked through. But I mean, I'm not sure of the kind of date of this chamber, because I mean, it seems fairly modern, because again, the brickwork is reasonably new, it's veneered. But I don't know, it's interesting to see this kind of modern and slight, slightly left on.
There's more of a whiff here, definitely, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, you can smell that we're not in a sanitised
mode. Yeah, we're not in a lab.
There's also this, I mean, seemingly really archaic wood here.
Yes.
Massive blocks of wood.
Yeah.
Buttress of this steel. I mean, this isn't something you'd think of as particularly modern.
That may be the old technology that superseded, and they just hadn't stripped it out.
So you think maybe it's just kind of useless?
This is newer, isn't it?
This smooth concrete.
You know, what is the point in breaking that down and taking it out, I suppose?
Yeah.
It's not doing any harm. Well, we've been up to see a surging cataract, a Niagara of shit, and other rainwater. And we backed off a little from that to hear about one of the great recurring myths of British folklore concerning tunnels. As I was saying, if you go anywhere, pop into a local pub, they'll tell you about a tunnel and how it links a couple of places of importance in that community. And one of the myths I came across time and again was the blind fiddler, the blind violinist. And typically there would be a tunnel in his community. And I heard the story in Richmond, in Yorkshire, in Cambridgeshire, in Norfolk, in Kent. There would be a tunnel linking two places, perhaps a graveyard and the local pub, or a monastery and the squire's house. And everyone was fascinated by the tunnel, but nobody was brave enough to go in. And they talk about this at the local pub. And the story goes that one day, George, as he was often called, the blind fiddler, said, look, I've had enough of this. I'm going to the tunnel. I'll show to you there's nothing to be scared of. So he would set off with his bill and typically his dog. They would go into the tunnel, and the people who made the bed with him would follow along the surface of the tunnel, listening to the music and following his progress. And he got so far into the tunnel that suddenly there was a terrible piercing shriek and the music stopped. And the people who made the bed with George rushed back to the mouth of the tunnel. And they were just in time to see his dog bolting out of it, whimpering, with all its fur singed off. But of poor old George, there was never a sight again. And the tunnel was sealed up. I came across this myth in Anstey in Hertfordshire. And there is a fiddler called George buried in the churchyard. He died of natural causes, and what all the locals insisted was a tunnel was really just a little cave, a little flint mine extending no more than a few metres underground. No shame to spoil the myth. It's amazing how they recur. And one of the other things about tunnel myths is these tunnels often stretch for miles, and yet they were built typically or perhaps hollowed out by supernatural forces long before we had the engineering chops to be able to make them ourselves. I mean, one of the most famous tunnels in the West Country was supposed to be 25 miles long, almost longer than the Channel Tunnel. Mm.
And what date was that? Was this kind of like an old...
Yeah, one of the interesting things, one theory is getting into deep psychogeography and topography, is that these are often places on the same ley line. And these are often points that are connected by a ley line, but you can't see one from the other. So old stories, old directions the country folk might have given, you go from the castle to the park to the monastery, get kind of confused into there's a tunnel between the castle and the park and the monastery. But there are some, there are definitely some, there are tunnels that religious people dug to escape the pursuivants, and others have hidden. There are smuggling tunnels on the coast, so they aren't all fables by any means.
Yeah, because obviously tunnels are, I mean, if you're coming out of Joseph Bazalgette, they're this big civic project for the greater good, but they can also be used kind of in inverted commas in the wrong hands.
Yeah. And there are caper movies. There's a slightly out of fashion movie called Loophole, in which a bunch of crooks use the sewers to plan a bank job. You can use them for nefarious purposes. And at the height of the IRA troubles, London Underground used to post men on the tunnels going under the river at night in case the IRA thought to go down there and blow them up and flood them.
Right. I know if you go beneath, I think it's number 10 or Westminster, I've heard tripwires in the tunnels. I don't know if they're laser tripwires or what, but apparently if you go through there, you'll be met by kind of guards with machine guns immediately as you step in there.
Well, I wonder if it would work so efficiently. Yes, but all the great apparatus of state can be removed underground. And your listeners have probably heard of COBRA, which is this committee of ministers and civil servants and army and security chiefs who meet when there's a crisis. Typically they met after 7/7. They met to discuss the millennial bug and so on, and the swine flu panic earlier this year. These meetings are held underground near number 10's fortified subterranean office.
They're actually held underground just because if someone managed to get to these people, it would be such a blow.
I think the wisdom of this was reinforced when the IRA mortared 10 Downing Street in John Major's time. And the mortars crashed into the garden of number 10. And ever afterwards it was thought, yes, we need to be able to get... I mean, what can you do in a hurry if you want to protect your cabinet and senior civil servants? You can't necessarily fly them out of central London. They could climb under their tables, I suppose, but the wisdom is to move them underground where they would be safe. And there are reports that as recently as the Tony Blair years, he and the Queen were seen in gas masks in the tunnels under Whitehall, going through a drill in the event of some unpleasantness visited on London.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the first example of this kind of underground threat is Guy Fawkes. I mean, obviously he doesn't connect to this idea of the underground as a safe place.
Well, it's a paradox. It's both those things. It's a place of safety for your treasures. Think of safety deposit vaults and so on. Crown jewels are kept underground in the Tower of London. But also it's a nasty, scary place. And it's a place where, from where you could be taken unawares, which was the whole idea behind Guy Fawkes. Well, Tom is disappearing up a ladder ahead of us. I can just see the soles of his welly boots and hear and feel the whatever it is he's dislodging on our heads. Tom is wrestling now with a manhole cover. How's it going up there?
It's pretty tough going, actually. I'm not sure whether there's someone standing on it.
We can actually feel rainwater coming down.
Yeah, well, it may just be water off Tom's boots. So maybe you need to get nearer to it, do you? Take your time, man. Do they lock them sometimes?
It seems to be on the right hand side.
Oh, really? They don't lock them to my knowledge.
After a few more attempts at opening the manhole, Stephen was eventually let out of the network of tunnels and released back into the world. Heading straight for a meeting at Television Centre, Stephen attempted to breathe what he described as a much-needed whiff of the netherworld back into the BBC. Stephen's new book, Underground England, is out now, published by Little Brown Books. Thanks for listening to this, the last in the series of Tunnel Vision. For episodes 1 to 9, plus a 1-hour studio discussion broadcast at the start of the series, go to residencefm.com/podcasts. For more information on the series, or any of its contributors, please contact brinvolucri@yahoo.co.uk.